flight podcast about everything you don't want to happen on your plane. I'm your host, Caroline Miller, and I have a good excuse for being so late with this episode. I was in the hospital because some of my, you know, vestigial internal organs decided to turn on me and go rogue. So, yeah, I had to go to the hospital and get surgery. So, sorry this is late, but that's why. I hope you guys are understanding. Yeah, I was having my own personal medical mayday that needed attending. So, anyway, thanks for your patience. Sorry this is so late.
We were literally about to record a mayday episode, and then Caroline's body went mayday. We sat down to record.
Okay, that's not true.
And she started speaking the opening line, and then she went, oh!
Welcome to But moving on from my personal problems, I'm back now, and everything seems to be fine. Fingers crossed, knock on wood. So today, we're going to talk about Delta Airlines Flight 191, which is the worst crash in Delta's history. And it also resulted in the longest aviation trial in history. It's a very, very terrifying flight. If you look at the crash animations of it, it gives me chills when I look at them because you can feel what it's like to be on the plane just by looking at the animations. It's freaky. Anyway, so with me today for this episode is Trevor. Hi, Trevor. Welcome back.
Hello.
So Trevor, you love Delta Airlines. In fact, you are kind of a Delta snob. And
what?
Yes, you're a Delta snob. Trevor's whole family is very much into Delta. So I think that this episode might make you a little bit uncomfortable.
This is slander in the highest degree.
It's not slander. I'm just saying something that happened.
Okay. Well,
oh, wait.
We'll see.
Are you saying that you...
I'm going to parse through this Delta misinformation, this Delta hate, and I think I'll be able to figure out what actually happened by the end.
Wow.
Because Delta is committed to safety.
Wow. Trevor's really... Do you work for Delta? What's happening right now? Anyway, never seen a man so personally invested in an airline that he has no obligation to, other than a SkyMiles card. So, let's get a little background before we get into the accident sequence of Delta 191. So, the flight itself, Delta Airlines 191, it was a regularly scheduled passenger flight from Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to Los Angeles International Airport in California, with a stopover in Dallas-Fort Worth in Texas. The plane being flown on that fateful day in August of 1985 was a Lockheed L-1011 385-1 TriStar series aircraft. It was 6 years old at the time of the crash, and it had been exclusively owned and operated by Delta for its entire lifespan. Also, sorry if my voice is a little scratchy. I had to shove a tube down my throat to intubate me during the surgery, and my throat still hurts. Anyway, moving on. Our crew consisted of three men. We have Captain Edward Michael Ted Connors, who was 57 years old, and he had been employed by Delta since 1954.
Wow.
Yeah. And he had, get this, 29,300 flight hours. That's a lot of flight hours.
Yeah, what could go wrong with this guy at the helm?
Well, that's...
First thing that's a bit suspicious.
Okay, Delta loyalist Trevor over here is already trying to blame other things. But we will get into it, because actually the level of fault at which Delta should be held for this crash is highly debated. Whoa. So it is good that you're so willing to defend Delta, because it'll make for an interesting discussion later, because there has been a lot of controversy over, is it the cockpit crew's fault or is it the fault of other entities, which we will get into in a little bit. Anyway, so the poor passengers never have anything to do with any of these, and they all always suffer the consequences, and it's not fair. So we have the captain, and he always flew by the book. He was known for being very routine, always taking the safe route, being very cautious. There was also 42-year-old Rudolph, nicknamed Rudy Price Jr., and he was a Delta employee since 1970, and he had 6,500 flight hours. And then last, but certainly not least, we have 43-year-old flight engineer Nicholas Nasik, who had been a Delta employee since 1976, and he had 6,500 hours of flight time under his belt as well. He was described as, quote, observant, alert, and professional by his colleagues. Captain Ted Connors was described as cooperative and open-minded, while he always tried to divert around storms for safety. That's going to be very important later. Like, Captain Connors always tried to divert around a storm rather than go through it to save time, even if other people were doing that. He's like, no, we're going to go around that. That was usually his MO when it came to flying around storms and weather systems. First Officer Rudy Jr. was remembered for being a, quote, above-average first officer who possessed, quote, excellent knowledge of the aircraft type that they were flying that day. All three men were military veterans, with both pilots being Navy vets and the flight engineer being an Air Force vet. 152 passengers boarded the plane that day, the vast majority of which came from the Miami metro area. The vast majority of them would not leave the aircraft alive.
Some people made it?
Yeah, there were some survivors, which is the only silver lining of this entire story. The aircraft took off from Fort Lauderdale at 2:10 Central Daylight Time on August 2nd, 1985. Shortly before takeoff, the weather forecast indicated to the crew that there would be scattered rain showers and thunderstorms around the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Anybody that lives in the Dallas-Fort Worth area knows that in this time frame, August, there's basically always thunderstorms and rain. It's quite normal for the Dallas area. And so the crew, they were aware of this. They've probably flown this route many times, and they are familiar with, obviously, how to land a plane in rain and thunder. So they're like, okay, we can do this. So they just make a little mental note, and they carry on their merry way. Because this is a jet plane. This is a commercial plane. It can handle a storm, as long as it's nothing too crazy. And as far as they were told, there was nothing crazy happening.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to the Dallas airport?
Actually, no, which is weird, because I lived in Texas, as did you, for years. Back to Flight 191. So soon, they were flying above New Orleans, Louisiana. And the crew learned at this point that a storm cell was growing in size and strength just south of them over the Gulf of Mexico. So Captain Connors, wanting to avoid a rough storm, said, hey, let's take a more northern path to DFW so we don't run into whatever is brewing down south. And the crew agreed with him and said, yes, that sounds like a good idea to me. Because, again, this is post-Tenerife, and in order to make big decisions like this, in order to change route, the entire cockpit crew has to agree. So Captain Connors said, shall we take a safer northern route? And the rest of the crew said, yes, let's take the safer northern route to avoid the storm. And they all said, let's do it. They got the clearance from air traffic control, and they did. So at 4:35, almost 2.5 hours into the flight, they got another message from the Automatic Terminal Information Service, and it said that there was bad weather on approach to DFW as well. So after receiving this message, they are cleared to fly to Blue Ridge, Texas, and to descend to 25,000 feet. A few minutes later, they're cleared down to 10,000 feet, and DFW ATC recommends a heading of 250 degrees for their final approach into DFW. But again, Captain Connors recognized the dangers of going straight through a storm cell and said, basically, hey, oh no, he said, quote, I'd rather not go through it. I'd rather go around it one way or another, end quote. So then after a bit of back and forth, the controllers agreed that a different heading would be appropriate, and they cleared them to descend to 9,000 feet on their new heading. So at this point, Captain Connors literally tells the controller how relieved he is that they don't have to fly directly through the storm, and after another couple of minutes, they are cleared to descend to 7,000 feet. So I'd like to take this moment to point out that Captain Connors has actively, twice now, made choices that are routing them around the storm, even though it's going to take more time. He's said twice, I want to go around the storm cell, and he's made active choices to avoid the storm. So I just want to note that here. So moving on, they're cleared to descend to 7,000 feet. After they're cleared to 5,000 feet, the controller informs them that the rain was now north of the airport, so DFW would be using instrument landing system approaches for all incoming flights. This means that radio beacons at the airport will help guide the planes in because the weather is crap and the visibility is also crap, so they just give them a little extra help.
Yay!
So, at 5 o'clock p.m., Delta 191 was told to slow down to a speed of 170 knots and turn to heading 270 on approach to land at runway 17L. Mm-hmm. 3 minutes later, the controller said, quote, "We're getting some variable winds out there due to a shower out there north end of DFW," end quote. Meanwhile, in the cockpit, somebody said, quote, "Stuff is moving in."
Stuff.
And again, they're just saying there's rain and variable winds.
I'm stuff.
Is that a reference? I feel like that's a... Oh, it is a reference. Ah, oh my gosh, I'm so foggy still. Anyway, and so you might be wondering, you know, Delta's not the only flight coming in to land. There's probably many other planes coming in to land at DFW at this time. It's one of the busiest airports in the country. And yes, there were. And all the other planes, they were coming in to land just fine, and things were looking okay for Delta 191, because if the flights around them were an indication, landing wasn't going to be a big problem. A Learjet right in front of them flew through the storm and only encountered, quote, light to moderate turbulence. So not thinking anything of it, the captain of the Learjet didn't report it to the control tower, because in hindsight, he said, why would I report light to moderate turbulence during a storm? That's like saying, you know, it's 2 p.m., the sun is shining, like it's just very obvious. So, mm-hmm. A few minutes after the Learjet landed, Delta 191 was spotted by air traffic control as it visibly emerged from the storm clouds. 12 seconds later, the captain got in touch with ATC and said, quote, "Delta 191 heavy out here in the rain feels good," end quote. The controller responded by relaying the weather information, which was that the wind was blowing at 5 knots with gusts of 15 knots. Soon after this, as they were lowering the landing gear, First Officer Price said, quote, "Lightning coming out of that one, right ahead of us." As Price flew the plane down to 1,000 feet, the captain told him to watch out for his airspeed, and the sound of rain pummeling the windscreen was heard on the CVR. Then, Captain Connors ominously says, quote, "You're gonna lose it all of a sudden, there it is." And then the aircraft plummeted wildly, and the captain says seconds later, quote, "Push it up, push it way up." And as the engines revved in the background, his voice continued on the CVR, quote, "That's it. Hang on to the son of a bitch." But at this moment, it was too late for Delta Airlines Flight 191, and the aircraft started a violent, unrecoverable descent as the passengers screamed in horror, sitting helplessly in their seats as they felt their stomachs drop. The nose of the plane was shoved down by the wind shear, and the plane sank below the glide slope of the ILS. Delta 191 was not only about to hit the ground far short of the runway, but it would crash in a very unlucky place.
What is the ILS?
Instrument landing system. It's the radio beacon system that can help planes be guided towards the airport in bad weather and poor visibility. So you can make a visual approach or an ILS approach. And because the weather was terrible, they're doing an ILS approach.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So, at 5:05, the ground proximity warning system started blaring in the cockpit as Captain Connors yelled, "TOGA," which is short for "push the engines to full throttle, abort the landing, and let's get the fuck out of here." The first officer did just that, and he pushed the Rolls-Royce engines to their limit and pulled up on the nose, but even this was not enough, and the plane continued its fatal plunge because of the insane wind shear that was being forced down on the top of the plane. Moments later, the plane touched down in a field nearly 2,000 meters short of the runway, but the plane didn't break apart immediately. In fact, it was so intact at this point that it continued rolling through the field at nearly 300 miles per hour. Now, you might be thinking, okay, they're rolling through a field, they're in one piece, that doesn't sound so bad, But here's the catch. The plane was approaching Texas State Highway 114, which has cars on it. And there's people inside the cars. As Delta 191 annihilated a streetlight, the nose gear touched down on the highway at a speed of at least 200 miles an hour. At this moment, 28-year-old William Mayberry was driving his Toyota Celica on Texas State Highway 114. As his windshield wipers were casually clearing the rain off of his windshield, he was probably enjoying his quiet drive up until this point. But upon hearing the screeching sound of metal on asphalt, he looked to his left in absolute horror as a massive passenger plane was speeding towards him. And moments later, the left engine of the plane crushed his car, killing him instantly. And he was only 28 years old, and if he had gotten on the road a few seconds earlier or a few seconds later that day, he would have lived. But on that horrible summer day, it was just incredibly bad luck, and he met a horrible, horrible fate. So, as the plane careened down the road, it continued smashing traffic lights and started to break into pieces. In the passenger cabin, panic began to break out as a fire started sweeping through the cabin. Some people decided to cut their losses and jump out of the still-moving broken plane, but they were killed by the violent forces exerted on their bodies as they were sucked out of the plane. Other people, hoping to play it safe, stayed inside the plane, but in a sick, extremely painful twist of fate, many of those people were doused in jet fuel and lit on fire in their seats. After a few more awful moments, the aircraft hit a water tank, and then a second water tank, and after the second collision, the body of the plane rolled violently to the left and was quickly completely engulfed in flames. And the only part of the plane with survivors in it, with minimal injuries, and there were also a couple people who had no injuries, miraculously, this is the tail section of the plane, it rips off the rest of the plane at this point, and it comes to rest sitting on its left side, but the wind was actually so violent that the wind pushed the fuselage upward until it stood in an upright position. Everybody who wasn't sitting in the very tail of the plane was now dead, with the exception of 11 critically injured people. In total, the crash of Delta 191 resulted in the death of 137 people, including the entire flight crew, most of the flight attendants, and the very, very unlucky driver of the Toyota Celica, William Mayberry.
Wow. How many people is that?
137. Within 60 seconds of the crash, every single emergency crew at DFW was notified of the accident, and three fire trucks were on their way to what remained of Delta 191. Even more fire trucks arrived minutes later, and because of the excellent work of the firefighters and the torrential rain, the jet-fueled blaze was extinguished within 10 minutes. Paramedics were on scene within 5 minutes and set up triage stations, and these proved to be crucial to the 27 survivors of the crash, some of whom were so severely injured that they couldn't physically leave the mangled aircraft. Most of them were completely soaked with jet fuel, which made their exit from the plane particularly treacherous, and according to the paramedics in a later interview, at least half of the passengers would have died if they had not set up the on-site treatment tents. Two people who initially survived later died at the Parkland Memorial Hospital, and so they are included in the 137 people who lost their lives that day.
Sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrible, and like, and what an awful way to die. Like, these people sitting in their seats thinking, okay, if I just sit here and I wait for this to stop moving, then I can leave the plane, and then they get covered in jet fuel and they get lit on fire and then they get burnt to death in their seats. It's a nightmare. One of the survivors said that the only reason that he didn't burn to death in his seat was because the opening, like, in the because his seat was close enough to a hole in the fuselage of the plane that the rain poured through the hole in the plane and onto him, so it was a flame retardant because it was raining on him just by chance. Now, let's get into the investigation.
Let's do it.
So the NTSB spent a very long time investigating this crash, and at the end of it all, they came to a conclusion that surprised me at first. They said that the primary reason for the crash was pilot error, because they decided to continue flying during storm conditions and attempt a landing during a thunderstorm. And while I agree that it was not a wise decision to continue flying and to try to land, it's worth noting that all the other pilots in the area were doing the exact same thing. Not only that, but as far as I can tell, the possibility of diversion was never brought up by either the Delta crew or ATC at DFW. So, yes, it was their fault, but I don't think it was an active negligence. They were just doing, as far as I can tell, they were doing what every other plane was doing, and they just were the unlucky plane that got caught and suffered the consequences of the weather. That's just my opinion. I could be wrong, but as far as I could tell, it's not like other planes were diverting to other airports. Another major factor that the NTSB pinned in the crash was the extreme weather phenomena and powerful wind shear as a result of a microburst. In addition, they blamed Delta for not enforcing rigorous training on how to handle extreme weather, specifically not training their pilots how to escape low-altitude wind shear, or how to avoid it altogether. But now here's where things get a little heated, because the NTSB said that part of why they crashed was because the weather radar on board the Lockheed L-1011 was not sophisticated enough to provide pertinent information in the situation, because their weather radar only detected and displayed information relating to rain and thunderstorms, but it had zero information on wind movements at all. So if the pilots had that information, I think that it's likely, especially given Captain Connor's hesitancy to fly through a storm, I think that they would have diverted or taken a different route if they had known that there was a wind shear alert and a microburst around them. But at the end of the day, all their radar said is that there was rain and a thunderstorm, and it didn't say anything else about wind, so they had no way of knowing. And it was the wind that pummeled them into the ground, not the rain.
Interesting.
Yeah. As a result of these findings, it's now a requirement that all commercial airliners have onboard wind shear detection systems. In a National Weather Service Heritage article aptly titled, "The Sky is Falling, Delta Airlines Flight 191 Crash," they go into detail about what exactly lives in the cockpit of today's planes and how it protects us. The Integrated Terminal Weather System, which was integrated and implemented in 2001, shows wind shear alerts, thunderstorms, gust fronts, and all sorts of other important information, and it can also predict the movements of storm cells and wind patterns up to an hour in advance. That's pretty cool, huh?
Oh my goodness. That's super cool.
Yeah, so if you're ever worried about, you know, oh my gosh, are they really going to fly through that big cloud that we're heading towards? They are fully aware of what it is. You're not going to have any surprises because of how sophisticated modern radars are.
They even know the radar. They can tell what you ate for lunch when you get on the plane.
They'd be like, you're going to have trouble in about 90 minutes. We're reserving the bathroom for you. You know that tuna at Subway isn't tuna, right? Looks like 16B doesn't know that.
It's monkfish.
Ugh. I gotta move on. Okay, but we're not done with the mess that unfurled in the wake of Delta 191 quite yet. Because another thing that the NTSB criticized was the airport's failure to notify auxiliary emergency personnel in a timely fashion. Because while the airport emergency staff were on scene in literal seconds, DFW Department of Public Safety Communications Center did not notify off-site emergency services until 10 minutes after the crash. And 10 minutes is a long time when you have people literally covered in jet fuel and on fire. Moreover, they did not finish notifying people until 45 minutes after the crash happened. The DFW DPSCC, also failed to get ambulances from the neighboring towns of Irvine, Grapevine, and Hearst altogether. They just didn't even bother getting ambulances from those towns. And the only reason that ambulances showed up from any of these places at all was because an employee at the Hearst Ambulance Company just happened to overhear chatter about the crash over a radio scanner.
Wow.
Yeah. So the airport really dropped the ball. Like, they were entirely depending on their own emergency crews, but they didn't ask for auxiliary help, which is a big red flag because it was a huge plane that crashed, and they definitely needed all the help they could get, and they just... It seems like they actively chose not to reach out.
Mm-hmm.
Delta, as an airline, did not appreciate the names of its deceased crew members being dragged through the mud after the crash. And Delta also did not appreciate its own name being dragged through the mud after the crash either. And they argued that the primary fault should not rest on the shoulders of their crew, but rather They said that the extreme weather combined with insufficient weather radar information and lack of pertinent information from air traffic control caused the crash. Because they argued that if the crew knew all the dangers that laid ahead of them in terms of wind shear, that they probably would have changed course. More specifically, Delta argued that the air traffic control at DFW should have been more explicit about the realities of wind shear and severe weather in the area. And that the blame is more on them, Delta says, than the cockpit crew of Delta 191.
100%.
Because remember, air traffic control only warned the crew of, quote, rain and thunderstorms, both of which are weather phenomena that a commercial jet can certainly handle. The National Weather Service and DFW disagreed with Delta's opinion, and because, you know, Delta's opinion made them look bad, so they took Delta to court, and this resulted in a 14-month-long investigation, which is the longest aviation trial in history.
Wow. Longer than the Sully trial?
Yep, longer than the Sully trial. And for what it's worth, a jury in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and remember, Fort Lauderdale is where this flight originated from. It's also where the vast majority of the people who were on board that plane, it's where they were living at the time. A jury in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, found Delta 100% blameless in the accident in a court hearing. They said, you know what, after looking at all this, I don't think the crew could have known anything different. You know, they did something that caused the crash, but they did not know it was going to cause a crash because they were not given enough information to make an informed decision. However, there was a second trial in Texas, and in Texas, a judge named David O. Ballou Jr. determined in a 72-page opinion that it was Delta's fault that the crash took place. And in essence, the judge said that the crew should have been able to infer that there was a dangerous wind shear based on the general weather information presented to them by air traffic control. Personally, I disagree with this, because as far as I could tell, air traffic control just said there's rain and thunderstorms. As a pilot, if you did a go-around or did a diversion every time there is rain or thunderstorms around an airport, you would have to do that, like, all the time. Planes land in rain and thunderstorms all the time. And I don't think, again, in my personal opinion, I don't think it's reasonable to just say, like, oh, well, they should have known better. Like, well, no, because all the other planes in the area were landing just fine. They were, the words wind shear were never said. Like, you can't, it's unfair. You can't expect a pilot to magically know something. It's your job as the weather service, as a controller, to explicitly tell a pilot, hey, there's a possibility of wind shear. Like, it just, it's your job. So, you know, you can't expect a pilot to be a mind reader. But again, that's my opinion. There's a lot of people who disagree with it, and that's totally fine. That's just my two cents. Anyway, so moving on. So a lawyer that was representing most of these survivors of the crash said that the ruling made them all, quote, very happy. And the lawyer said that the survivors felt from the beginning that Delta was the only negligent party in this case. And then furthermore, the judge said that, quote, the court considers the failure of governmental employees to pass on weather information to have been inconsequential to the fate of 191 in that there is no evidence that the crew would have acted differently with this confirmation of information already known. So, in regular words, what he's saying is, well, we think that even if they had told them that there was wind shear, which they didn't, we don't think the pilots would have done anything anyway. And I think that that is very unreasonable because it's A, they did demonstrate, Captain Connors demonstrated multiple times that he wanted to avoid storms. He changed heading and he changed his route to a northern route to avoid storms. So I think that he did indicate that if he was given the information, he would have changed course. And also, you can't just say stuff like that. You can't just assume like, oh, well, I don't think they would have done it anyway, because at the end of the day, they were never given the information, they never had the chance to make the decision, and now they're dead. Mm-hmm. So it's just very unreasonable to assume, like, well, I don't think they would have done it anyway. Yeah. Like, that's fine if that's your opinion, but you can't just say as a judge that that should be treated as a legal fact, you know?
True.
I will also add that there are some media reports, and this is true, that Captain Connors was using prescription Valium and Stelazine at the time of the crash, and some places say, oh, this may have impaired his judgment, but they, again, they were prescription, and he was taking them as prescribed by his doctor. They're both sedatives. Stelazine can also be used for schizophrenia, but you can't be a pilot and have schizophrenia at the same time. So, I mean, he definitely was just taking these medications to sleep. And there was nothing noted about unreasonable levels of these medications in his system at autopsy, which leads me to believe that they were just at therapeutic levels. And I don't think that, you know, they should be taken into consideration when determining who caused this crash. And in fact, the courts also thought that the medications were inconsequential because they even ruled it out as evidence. They considered, you know, should we take these sedatives that he was taking into account as evidence for this court case? And then eventually they said no, because there was just very, very, very little to no evidence that his use of these prescription drugs was impairing his judgment. And honestly, I would rather have a pilot who was taking sleeping medication as prescribed by his doctor than a pilot who isn't taking sleep medication and he hasn't slept in a week. I would much rather have the pilot who has slept with the help of sleep medication than a pilot who can't sleep.
True. An insomniac pilot.
Yeah, that does not sound good. So my official stance on this is that I'm glad that Captain Connors was getting help via prescriptions for sleep. I don't think, and the evidence seems to support the idea, that his prescriptions had nothing to do with this crash. So if you see that mentioned, you can just, in my opinion, brush it off. Yeah, so what do you think, Trevor? Lay out your theory.
So it all started when Captain asked to the first diversion from the storm, because ATC told him to come in at a certain heading, and he said, actually, no, let's do this one. So I think that pissed off ATC. They said, these Delta pilots always come in here thinking they can run the place and make their own directions and cut off other planes' routes.
Okay, that's totally not how air traffic control thinks.
They sent them on that route, on this other route, knowing it would send them through the storm. Knowing there was the wind shear.
You're insane.
Knowing.
This is actual nonsense. That is the worst theory I've ever heard.
And it's total nonsense. It's just, it's kangaroo court.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is that
Delta did nothing wrong.
What I'm taking away from what you just said is that ATC sabotaged this flight because Captain Connors asked for a different heading to land.
It was cumulative. They just hate Delta, I think. They wanted to send a message.
This is like when your mom flew American and then her Delta Platinum luggage tag was ripped off and she was like, American hates me.
Yeah.
This is like that, except Trevor, you're being completely ridiculous.
No,
air traffic control never does that. Air traffic control never sabotages anybody. Their job is to help the planes land no matter what. It has nothing to do. You're crazy.
What? I don't know. This is a different time. This is the 80s, baby. This is different.
Their job is to land planes safely no matter what. And I think that air traffic control is partially at fault, but I don't think that they sabotaged anybody. Trevor's crazy. Don't listen to him. 10 years after the crash, the family, friends, and survivors of Delta 191 gathered in Florida, the flight's origin, to remember that tragic day in 1985. In 2010, on the 25th anniversary of the crash, a permanent memorial was erected at the DFW Founders Plaza. The survivors of the crash have talked extensively about the horrors that they endured that day, watching the people around them die and burn, and just the amount of survivor's guilt that they have grappled with since the crash. Their accounts were documented by author Michael Connelly, who wrote an article about their stories, and that article was actually a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize.
Whoa.
Yeah, wow. So that's all I have for Delta Airlines 191. I hope the passengers and the crew who lost their lives that day are at peace. I hope the survivors have gone on to live their lives as best they can, and I'm very grateful for the changes made to airline weather protocols, equipment, and training. Trevor, any closing thoughts that aren't completely insane?
This is also, it's also why you always got to be careful when you're driving by an airport. Keep your head on a swivel. You never know where a plane may come from out of nowhere.
Yeah, it's some Final Destination stuff. So if you have any thoughts, corrections, or suggestions, please send them to maydaymaydaypod@gmail.com. If you like the show, give it a review. Until next time, be safe, be cautious, and look out for wind shear. Bye-bye.
Bye.